Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. Dan Rodericks here, Sun columnist, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 388 for Tuesday, May 15th, 2018. Exhibit A arrived by email just as I was producing today's show. It's a letter from a Baltimore Sun reader in Western Maryland in response to a column I wrote about migrant or seasonal workers and the need for them in the United States each spring and summer. Employers can't find enough Americans willing to pick crab meat or pick vegetables or spread mulch. And this reader has an explanation for that. Quote, "From my experience as an employer of hundreds over the years, and as one who came from the lower classes, as well as one who still associates with the lower classes, it's because so many are getting a check. I live in Appalachia, and even here in this depressed area, employers can't find help. The workers are here, but they don't want a regular job. It's easier to go on disability. Take my neighbor. He's young, strong as an ox, and perfectly capable of manual labor. He side jobs logging, hauling scrap metal, working on cars, and participates in every demolition derby that's held in the area. But he gets that check. It leaves him plenty of time for hunting and fishing. I don't know all the ropes because I've never in my 64 years drawn even a dime of unemployment, but apparently once you get that disability check, you become eligible for all sorts of free stuff at the taxpayer's expense. My wife and I pay over $2,000 a month for health insurance, while more than half of the people I grew up with, and especially their kids, get theirs free, courtesy of social safety nets. Those safety nets have become hammocks. Is it any wonder Americans don't want these jobs?" The letter is signed by Paul Christian, who would be approaching the age when Medicare kicks in, so he and his wife will soon be getting a big break on health insurance, courtesy of the federal government, part of the social safety net. This is not the first time I've received an email from a reader relating an anecdote about some no-account neighbor who's getting over on the welfare system. But it comes as Donald Trump orders all federal departments to look for ways to make able-bodied people who get benefits, such as Medicaid or food stamps, into the workforce. There is this big Trumpian Republican idea that the country is supporting a bunch of lowlifes and frauds with welfare. The Trump administration claims it is looking to get people off the dole, allowing states to attach work requirements to food stamps and Medicaid. We've heard all this before, going back to the Reagan administration. The approach fails to recognize the millions of Americans who are considered to be working poor, that is, employed but with annual household incomes below the federal standards for poverty. As an example, recently cited by the New York Times, a 2017 study of Michigan's Medicaid program found that three-quarters of those enrolled were already working or physically unable to do so. Another 12% were people likely to be exempt, including the elderly and students. The Trumpian Republican approach also fails to recognize the welfare reforms that occurred over the last 20 years, to the point where the welfare we once knew has been time-limited, winnowed to a tiny percent of the federal budget, and its recipients required to work. As for Mr. Christian's neighbor, perhaps he's getting over it. There are a lot of slackers in this country, no doubt. But perhaps Mr. Christian makes too many assumptions. You can't get a disability check unless you've been declared disabled for mental or physical reasons by doctors and the Social Security Administration. And those standards started getting tougher 3 decades ago during the Reagan administration. Able-bodied men in the United States get no cash assistance from the government, other than an unemployment check. Maybe landscapers can't find help because they don't pay enough for the work and the hours they require. Maybe local workers don't own cars and can't get to work on time by bus. Maybe there are not enough unemployed people in a given area. The unemployment rate in the U.S. is currently at 3.9%. And many economists agree that growth won't rise above what we now see without an influx of immigrants. Over on the affordable housing front, Trump's HUD secretary is former Johns Hopkins surgeon Ben Carson, a strident Christian who thinks laws banning discrimination and programs to subsidize rent for low-income families amount to social engineering and ought to be curtailed. Fortunately, fair housing advocates are suing Carson over his reversal of policies to roll back segregation. So, with that as a backdrop, part two of my recent conversation with a man who is considered a scholar on social policy, Michael Reich, a professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and, as you'll hear, a one-time resident of public housing. Today, we focus on the Trump administration's audit of the social safety net and why so many Americans who benefit from it or have it as a backup feel so strongly that it's some sort of massive fraud.
Well, I think it comes from a lot of the powerful forces in our history. The emphasis on individual responsibility and pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, this independent, self-supporting, self-sufficient family. I mean, it comes out of a myth, but it's a very powerful myth in our society. And the notion that goes back even before we were a nation, that people who need assistance, unless they're of a particular category, like, you know, the elderly ill or little children, are, you know, the unworthy poor. And therefore, you know, they are exploiting society, they're lazy, et cetera. And then in the 20th century, that increasingly got associated with a racial bias, so that they're disproportionately people of color, even though that has not been true ever, but that's the way people act. But I think in terms of how people respond to the whole notion of social welfare in our society, people want the assistance there, but one aspect of it is that they don't want it to go to others, mm-hmm. only to them, and also they feel guilty that they need it. So there's this little bit of shame associated. You know, look at how people feel, for example, when they get unemployment insurance.
Some people hate to admit that they had to get it.
Or people applying for food stamps.
Yeah.
And they're ashamed that, and this goes back to the Depression in the 30s. People would get, you know, desperately need the aid literally to survive, and yet the cultural message that they get is that there's something wrong with you if you are getting this aid, and therefore people feel guilty about it. But what are they going to do? They're going to turn that against themselves? No, they turn it against the whole concept and those others who are getting it like I am, mm-hmm. but they don't really deserve it. They're gaming the system. So I think it's another button that
Trump has been pushing.
Yeah.
Look at the food stamp thing, for instance. This is going on in state capitals around the country where work requirements are being attached to that. We're going to conduct investigations to make sure you're able, not able-bodied or something, if you're actually on disability collecting food stamps, or could you work in return for receiving this benefit?
At the same time as they're cutting job training programs, job support programs, educational programs that might enable people to work, and healthcare programs that might enable people to get healthy.
I hear quotes from people on the right, Republicans, who say we need to break the cycle of poverty by getting people off of food stamps, by getting them off of these programs, which all sounds great, but their wages are still not great. Don't get them out of poverty.
Well, it's a combination. I mean, this message that we need to cut welfare has been, you know, it was said even by Roosevelt 80 years ago, you know, he made this speech, we have to get out of this business of relief. One can criticize that from a certain perspective, but at least he proposed something else. He created public sector jobs. And I think he was right that most people who are able-bodied would far prefer to work and get the dignity of labor and get a benefit rather than, you know, get a relief or welfare check. But what we don't recognize is that the overwhelming majority of people who get all of these benefits, whether it's public assistance, you know, cash assistance or food stamps or any other form of health care aid, that the overwhelming majority of them cannot work. We fail to recognize that. It's just like, oh no, they must be cheating the system. But for various reasons, health care reasons, mental health reasons, substance abuse reasons, and this cuts across all races in society. One other thing just to throw in, studies have shown that when people are asked, you know, whether or not they get government assistance, most people say no. Yet if you look at what they actually do, most people in their lifetimes have gotten some form of government assistance. So there's this whole denial People want to believe that they're self-sufficient, or that if they get any benefits, it's because, well, I'm entitled to them, I paid for them. And they deny those benefits to other people who may have also contributed in very different ways. Part of the pressure to force people who are getting assistance to work is because of the sense that, well, they owe something to society if society is going to contribute, you know, to their benefit. So you have to have worked to get unemployment insurance. You have to work to get TANF. And now, increasingly, food assistance, or if they have their way, housing and Medicaid as well.
Several states already have a work requirement for food stamps, right?
Right. The proposal that's in Congress would extend that nationally. And I think three or four states have already applied for a waiver to require people on Medicaid to work, and about seven other states are considering it. So that's a trend, and the Trump administration opened the door to that. We have this notion of a social contract for that we apply one way to certain classes of people, that they are obligated to work for meager benefits, but we don't have a reciprocal contract for people for whom we give lots of benefits, like tax cuts or oil depletion allowances or heavy subsidies of their industry.
I'm not sure I follow that, because you can't benefit from huge tax cuts unless you're already making lots of money.
No, right? but we don't expect them to contribute back to society the same way. So you have to work in terms to get a meager benefit.
Right.
But here, there's no expectation that you will return anything to society.
Well, the assumption there on the trickle-down side, the supply side economics, is that if you give the big tax cuts to corporations, for instance, or to stockholders, the so-called job makers, job creators, there will be a benefit to the greater society.
Right, but for 40 years, that's been proven wrong. So I don't know how long, you know, fool me once, shame on you, and fool me twice, whatever. The other thing is that it also relates to a different interpretation of the work ethic, and I think they're related, this whole notion. This is not original to me. I mean, I think John Kenneth Galbraith wrote about this years ago. He said that for low-income and working-class people, you have to work in order to get anything in society, whether it's a wage or a social welfare benefit. But it's reversed for the wealthy. You have to work regardless of the rate of return, whether it's a minimum wage or a meager social welfare benefit. But for the wealthy, it's unless you get a certain rate of return, you don't have to work. You have no incentive to work, and work for the wealthy is investment. So they don't feel compelled to invest unless they're guaranteed in one way or another a certain rate of return. But the lower income people must work under any circumstances. So we apply this concept very, very differently to different social classes and groups in our society.
We had a story in the paper recently about the number of people with mental illness seeking help in emergency rooms in Maryland. And it just dawned on me at that moment, you have these moments where you say, we are not an exceptional country. When we have this problem that we can solve, that we know how to solve, and we have the wealth to do it and the know-how to do it, and yet we have this crisis.
I have a good friend whose wife is Swedish. She has dual citizenship, and their son was born with very severe autism some years ago. He's now a teenager. And they tried in several different states in the Midwest to get adequate services for him, either in the public schools or the social services, and they were fierce in their advocacy, and they couldn't get anything. So eventually,
they moved
back to Sweden, or they all moved to Sweden, and there they get a family allowance and special cash assistance to help deal with their son, and they have I don't know what exactly title they have, but they have people who come into their home to work with their son virtually every day. And the child, he's a teenager now, a youth, he's never going to, quote, get better, but he's so much happier and is living a life of dignity now. Now, what will happen to him when they get too old to care for him? I don't know enough about that. But he is cared for now in a way that could not be cared for in the United States. And here's a perfect example. Despite all the conspiracy mongers about why kids get autism, what control do they have over that? It's just the bad roll of the dice.
Right.
And yet we can act with compassion to people who are in those particular circumstances. It's a sign of the deficiency of our society and our culture. I mean, that should apply not just to autistic children, but to anyone, youth or adults.
And we have the power and the wealth to take care of our people.
Yeah, that's what's so disheartening. I mean, we do. And you know, the growing inequality in our society, which has occurred, here's a bipartisan criticism, across every presidential administration for the last 40, 50 years. At some point, yeah, I'm tempted to ask a very naive question. How much wealth is enough? I mean, when you talk about people, even people who give a lot of it away, you know, billionaires,
yeah.
How many meals can you eat a day? How many cars can you drive? How big a house do you need?
When the tax cuts went through this time, I'm just kind of amazed and shocked by it. That at this stage, we're still doing this.
Well, when you originally sent me the article, we were talking about the proposals that Ben Carson was making.
Increase the rent expected of people who receive federally subsidized housing.
Right. Yeah. I grew up in public housing in New York City.
I remember you saying that. Yeah.
And from before I was 3 years old until I graduated from college. And I remember, and I use this as an example in some of my classes, I remember what happened when they made a shift from public housing basically for the working class. But even then it was segregated. There were African-American public housing and white public housing. And then when they, in an attempt to be more progressive, I suppose, admitted more people who were much lower income, including people on welfare, to public housing, and including the housing project that I grew up in. And one of the things that happened at that time concurrently, and it wasn't noticed at first, was there used to be two maintenance workers for every building. There were seven buildings in my project, and they did a terrific job. The buildings were clean, the elevators worked, the lights were always on, the garbage was picked up. They put up Christmas decorations and the whole bit. Concurrently, with the change in the population of the project, they reduced the support staff so that there was one worker for every two buildings rather than two workers for every single building. There were seven buildings in total. So what happened, of course?
Can imagine, yeah.
Right? Things broke down. Things were not cleaned up. And then that creates a whole psychology. People see that the floors aren't clean, so they drop garbage on the floor. But what happened to a lot of the people who had been there before? They associated it, at least initially, not with the cuts, but with the change in the population.
Mm-hmm.
And it just fed into the anti-welfare, people of color
right.
narrative.
Right. So, and look what we ended up with public housing,
yeah.
with a high concentration of poor black residents in Baltimore City.
Right.
Right.
A couple of years ago, I went back to my old public housing development with my daughter because she had never seen where I grew up. And it was interesting. I didn't go in the building. You now needed to be buzzed in the building or have a key. It was better security. And apparently that happened because a tenants association had developed and created all these things. But the grounds were clean. There were new benches. It still looked like public housing.
Mm-hmm.
But
what's the difference? Is it working poor? Is it just better management? Or?
I don't know. I mean, I think the tenants association made a difference.
Probably
helps. They made the place safer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did a study in the 90s in San Francisco as part of the baseline study for the Hope 6 housing program that the Clinton administration was developing. And with a colleague and a few students, I went into some of the public housing in San Francisco. And, you know, I grew up in the streets of New York, but I was scared going into those buildings. We were interviewing tenants, getting information. The hallways were dark. They were disgusting. We had our physical selves threatened on more than one occasion. We were tabling in front of one of the building, getting people to sign up to do these interviews with us and, you know, offering them some modest reimbursement. Someone threw a dog off the building that landed right near us.
Off the roof?
Off the roof, yeah, wow. As a way of threatening us. We had to meet with people off the site because there were gangs that were basically running the project. So it was really pretty bad. I don't think it's like that in the place that I grew up right now.
Well, there's been a lot of progress in public housing, especially in the last 20 or 30 years. There's still a long waiting list of people in Baltimore City who need public housing and can't afford a place to live. But we tore down the high rises and built some mixed income housing in two different places in Baltimore.
Well, I think it might have been part of the same Hope 6 program.
Hope 6.
And I went back to the Hope 6 developments in San Francisco and Oakland, California, and the neighborhoods are attractive now.
Yep.
And they blend in seamlessly to the surrounding area. You see these two-story townhouse looking things. Each family has its own entrance, and you would think, oh, this is a working class neighborhood. But the problem is that at least a third of the people who used to live there were displaced. And what happened to them?
I know in Baltimore, they were dispersed. They went elsewhere. But you have mixed income properties now, right? And they're better kept and they're still subsidized for people of low income. So this is an important mission still of housing and urban development, right? To support or subsidize people who can't afford a place to live.
Absolutely.
We don't have enough affordable housing. That is a crisis in the United States.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the reasons why we have more homelessness and why the severity of homelessness is worse.
So then you have Ben Carson proposing raising rent on people who are in this position. This is a counter to the mission of HUD. And I think what's going on in the Trump administration is a lot of that, basically sabotage of good government.
Yeah, and which in turn feeds the narrative that government is ineffective.
So we've come full circle in this conversation.
But it's crazy about this. I mean, the people who live in public housing now especially are people who cannot find work for one reason or another. I mean, they're disproportionately the elderly, the disabled, children, or adults with very young children. They've already made it, stricter requirements there by throwing people out if anyone in their family was involved with, abusive substances. So there's no rationale for this other than to be punitive and mean and to require people to work when there are no jobs and many of them are, for one reason or another, not capable of work.
You're teaching a class in comparative social policy.
Mm-hmm.
It occurs to me, maybe we can end on this note, get your comments on this, that in the United States, even though we are a wealthy country with what we think are all kinds of resources in government and in the private sector, that there's a lot of uncertainty for people of certain income levels that you're not sure you're going to eat if you lose your job. You're not sure you're going to be able to find another job. You're not sure you're going to be able to be cared for if you're sick, even if you have health insurance, right? There's a certain precariousness about it all. There's no guarantee. When you're talking about a social contract, I don't think people believe in it thoroughly, or that there's going to be enough money for your retirement, for instance.
Yeah, I think that insecurity about everything, all the things that you listed, will I get health care if I'm sick? Will I have enough money when I retire? And that's, you talk about a soon-to-occur crisis. Most Americans don't have anything to retire. And what's going to happen to them? What are we going to do?
You mean you don't have a pension aside from their Social Security?
Yeah. I mean, are we going to have elderly people on the streets? I mean, how will we tolerate that? But I think this whole notion of constant insecurity, economic insecurity, cultural insecurity, physical insecurity, I think it's fed by so many things in the media. It's fed by our politicians. And I think it's designed to make people accept whatever is and not complain about it and not organize against it and not see who's benefiting from the current stratification of our society. And then with what we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation about getting people who are suffering to blame other people who are suffering for their plight, not look at where the real source of the problem is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
Michael Reich is the Daniel Thurs Distinguished Professor of Social Justice at the University of Maryland and one of the leading social work scholars and educators in the country. He joins us from time to time on Roughly Speaking to talk about social policy and politics. That's our show for now. Your thoughts are always welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please tell your friends about the podcast. And if you get a chance, review our show on iTunes or your Apple Podcast app, or for Android users on Stitcher. For the producers, Steve Early and Quinn Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.